Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed that little break there. And my very special guest is still Rick Osman. We're talking about his favourite little period of history around the early 1820s, isn't it? This is your favourite period of American history. From ancient to today, this is it. I don't know. I don't know about that for my personal flavour, because I don't know much about that period of history, and I'd appreciate it if you'd continue to regale me.
Sure. In particular, because I grew up here in Indiana, I'm very familiar with the history, the early history of its settlement, and even before the white settlers were here, the white traders were here, and as well as the missionaries and a lot of other folks. But the interaction of whites in this region with the natives goes back to at least about 1520, because in some of the Native American villages or places where there were Native American villages, you occasionally find artifacts of Spanish conquistadors or French missionaries or French traders and the stuff that they left behind, either as trade goods or lost in battle because that conquistador didn't make it. We have also the Native American lore, the spoken history, is much more manifest and much more, encompassing than most of the doctrinal historians would have you believe. Certain tribes have a history, a tribal history of how their tribe, in this case the Ojibwa, controlled the rivers. They were like the NYPD, if you will, of the rivers system of North America, meaning two-thirds.
Meaning they were controlled by gangs and organized crime?
Well, they certainly had their bouts with other entities for control of the river or river systems. And the reason they wanted to control it was so that they could collect basically a toll or a fee for trading up and down the rivers. Well, the same thing at the same time was happening in the old world with the Romans. Okay, they dressed differently. They spoke a different language. They wrote differently. And yes, the Native Americans did have writing. They just don't want us to know that. Because they also had records. They just didn't use books exactly.
You ever heard the phrase, great minds think alike?
Yeah.
Yeah. Scumbaggery minds think alike too.
Yes, they do, certainly. And when they have a secret to keep, they do it very, very well. When the Romans would invade someplace, let's take Carthage as an example. Yeah, they sowed salt in all the Carthage so that it wouldn't grow wheat. Well, they didn't grow wheat in Carthage itself anyway. They grew it around Carthage. What they actually did in Carthage was they stole all the libraries and they culled the books for anything that could be of use to Rome. When they finally sacked Sicily, there was a standing order to capture Archimedes alive because they wanted that brain. That was the very first example of Operation Paperclip, if you know that one. But they wanted to capture the enemy brains and use them. The Romans, when they conquered some place, the first thing they wanted was the history so they could find out where those places were trading and what they were trading for and how they did it and how they got there, etc. And one example of that that we know happened is Carthage had a copper mine, a little bit of silver, a little bit of gold also, in Spain, a place that today is called Rio Tinto. And a mining company is named Rio Tinto because of that mine that was there that the Romans reopened in the first century BC and mined for about 200 years. And then they just kind of let it go to waste. And then in the 19th century, a London company reading Roman history found out, hey, they had a mine. We should go check it out. And they formed a mining company and they mined it for another 100 years. And now Rio Tinto is one of the largest copper mining outfits in the world. So the use of history to discern trade routes, trade goods, good, bad, or indifferent, is something that Rome used effectively. The very early United States did that as well. As an example, back to the copper, when Benjamin Franklin was negotiating the treaty with the English at the end of the revolution, our revolution, the war for independence, depending on where you are, what you call it, he negotiated for a place called Isle Royal. It's an island out in the middle of Lake Superior, and they had to make a big jog out around it to draw the new boundary line. But he said, I'm not leaving here without that island. And that was the copper that was mined during the 19th century, all, you know, 5, 10, 50 million pounds of it, whatever it actually was. Somebody put a bug in his ear that, hey, you want that island. And it about had to have been the French allies, because they were the only ones who'd spent a lot of time around there. So the history was there from someplace. How the French got it, I don't know.
Well, how does a Frenchman normally discern secrets from his enemy? He sleeps with his wife.
Yeah, seduction. That's right.
You'll be surprised how sexy a Frenchman is if you've had enough French wine.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to the very first Indiana Jones movie. But, oh, wait, he grew up on that stuff.
Yeah, it's true. Now, speaking of which, the French have an interesting relationship here for New Zealanders as well, because when our indigenous people, the Maori, were signing a treaty with the British, it occurred to a lot of historians, honest ones at least, that the Maori were actually quite hurriedly trying to get a treaty with the British, principally because they wanted British protection from the French.
Yeah. Well, and they also already had their history of dealings with the Portuguese, or somebody who certainly resembled the Portuguese in the very early 16th century. Spaniards. And the Portuguese had been, but the Portuguese had already been trading with Japan for 100 years before that, according to the Japanese.
There's also a story. I'm sorry. I'm still interrupting you, Rick. Please continue.
Okay. Well, going back to the Japanese and their trade organization or trade relations with Western Europe, there were some 4th century Roman glass beads found in a 4th century Japanese tomb. That means it was pretty, you know, rapid transit. They had a regular trade route throughout Eurasia. You find Roman coins throughout India and Sri Lanka and even into Vietnam. The historians say, oh, no, they didn't do that. They couldn't possibly have traded that far. Really? Because when Cleopatra was, well, when she killed herself rather than be captured, she was about to board a ship to go to India and escape. They had regular trade routes from Egypt, too. But in that case, she would have had to have either gone out the Red Sea or circumnavigated Africa. So they had some pretty sophisticated sailing and navigation. I guess that's where I'm going with that.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have no Suez Canal, so you could just take a shortcut, you know.
Well, and they didn't have 747s, per se.
Oh, in fact, that reminds me of a joke. There's a Maori comedian called Peel. And he was in a car with an islander guy, you know, from Tonga. And the guy from Tonga says, you Maori are frickin' stupid, eh? You know, you sail here in these little rickety ships from all the way across the seas and risk your life and limb. We just wait for the Palangis to build a 747.
Yeah. Yeah, or the Chinese, because they're building their own now.
Hey, the Chinese are building their own everything now. Have you noticed?
Yeah, they're building a lot of our stuff too.
Yeah,
I own about a half a dozen Chinese built guitars.
Hey, when was the last time you walked into a store and you thought that and you really could be convinced that nothing there was from China?
Wow, that's been a while.
It's been about 30 years or something, hasn't it?
Unless you go to the local artisan-only shops. And we do have a couple of those. They don't have anything practical. It's all art, decorations, etc.
Stuff that you don't need. In fact,
stuff you don't need. That's right.
Haven't you noticed that's kind of like a coming trend with all of our Western societies? None of us are producing stuff that we actually need. We're all service industry oriented, which means we need other people and their money and their resources and their processing and their labor to survive. We have no independence of any kind.
Well, we have limited independence here because where I am in southern Indiana, we still have a lot of farm ground. And I live at the edge of an Amish community. So they're fairly well, you know, I won't say totally independent, but they're fairly self-sufficient. And therefore, a lot of the goods that support self-sufficiency are readily available here. Things to cook and heat a home and, you know, transport without oil or electricity are here. So I'm well availed of things for self-sufficiency,
and oddly enough. And that's just you. You'd be in a very unique position by comparison to, say, the average resident of Los Angeles County or New York City.
They're all screwed. 3 days and all the grocery stores are empty. Seriously, both those cities.
And the way people panic by it won't be 3 days, mate. It'll be 3 hours.
Oh, yeah, agreed. You know, one snowstorm and not necessarily in either one of those cities, but one snowstorm in a major city and the shelves are empty. But at one point in time, they're going to be empty, never to be refilled.
Or they'll be refilled and they'll be so expensive that you can't buy it.
Yeah, well, either way, they're screwed. All those people are done.
Well, this doesn't fly in the face with Agenda 21, does it? see, I was just thinking about this as well, because on the one hand, we have the quote-unquote collapse of society thing looming in on us because of struggling resources, climate collapse, Fukushima. Name your end-of-the-world disaster. It's already going on, you know. A lot of people say it's inevitable. There's limits to human creativity. There's no outwitting a bell curve of population explosion and then decline. There's no possible way out of that. And then on the other hand, what I see is Agenda 21 being implemented all over the place to ensure that that collapse happens and collapses in a controlled fashion. So that it won't be all of these crises and everything that kill you. It'll be the people that are telling you about these crises and giving you the solutions to the problems that'll kill you.
Yeah. Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Isn't that a profound realization? That no matter how bad things get, the people who are talking about how bad things are actually probably the thing most likely to kill you.
Yes. And the least likely to kill us in mass is the one that we can't possibly escape and they can't possibly control. And that's a big asteroid.
Yeah.
But back to that coronal mass ejection, if that happens, society will collapse. Many millions, tens, hundreds of millions, possibly billions of people will starve to death for lack of electronic communication. Hey, we need a truckload of anything to eat. And oh, why? What do you mean the truck won't run? It's diesel. Well, yeah, but it's got electronic injectors on it. So even a diesel's not going to run.
Yeah, nothing's going to work, eh? You'd be basically back to steam engines and even telegraph won't work. Steam engines
well, not
and
until
horseback.
You string some new lines.
Pardon?
Not until you string some new lines for the telegraph. Yeah. The only vehicles that will survive intact at the moment that coronal mass ejection hits are the submarines who are submerged more than, you know, 3 to 30 feet, depending on where they are in the world and which side it actually hits. They will survive. Their electronics will be intact. The only problem is the only people they'll be able to talk to is each other. And they don't want to do that because, oh, wait. They're the only surviving nuke force.
But what about the satellites? Wouldn't they all be knocked out by it? So that would the submarines wouldn't even be able to communicate with each other. Maybe what shortwave? I don't know how
long. Actually, very very low frequency. ELF, extremely low frequency, is how they would communicate. They can communicate with each other. They can communicate with various naval centers that have that particular setup, except that those centers will no longer exist because all their antennas are going to be fried. But subs could talk to each other in a limited fashion.
What about...
It's a very slow communication.
There would be sub-communication. You said between 30 feet. What about the deep underground military bases that have been exposed and talked about all over the planet, underwater ones as well? They'd all be running high as life.
They would survive that event. Well, their electronics would survive that event. Okay. The people probably would not be affected directly by the event. Only their lifestyle would change. Everybody here on the surface is going to be pretty much screwed as far as communications, transportation, cooking appliances, refrigeration. All that's going to be gone. There will be no power unless you can make it with your own wind turbine and manufacture your own generator, because those are going to fry too. Any of the long lines are going to be screwed.
There will be one group of people, ordinary people, topside, that have no technology. And there will be a second group of people, powerful people, who have technology. What do you think that is going to happen to the rest of society? It's just going to become a technocratic elite coming up out of the ground. Boom. We rule you. We've got all the weapons. We've got all the tech. Technocratic society. Well, at least that's what I'd do if I was a totally crazy criminal psychopathic scumbag.
Well, there's another side to that coin, though. All of us up here, we may not have communications, but we control all the food.
However, storable food within the United States from all of the major suppliers is currently on between a 3 to 18 month wait list, because the government and major corporations have come in and bought out pretty much all the freeze dried food. So these people will have stockpiles of food, munitions, fuels, advanced technology, communications, and we'll have none of that, more or less.
We'll have food. We won't have the long-term storage food. We'll be going from season to season, just like the ancients did. Oh, wait, even they would store food. They had dried fish, dried meat. They had pemmican. They had beans and rice and you name it. They had a lot of stored foods, stored as dry grain. It'll keep you alive until you can do better.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think if in the case of a coronal mass ejection, one country has dealt with an energy shock before, where suddenly no energy was coming in, they're all oil embargoed and everything like that. What did they do? Cuba. They said to the people, grow food everywhere. Every patch of grass that is not being used to grow food, every bit of arable land in the entire country, if it ain't being used to grow food, occupy it, start growing it. Nobody starved to death, and they are currently one of the healthiest populations on Earth with the least amount of health problems.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. They have a lot of mental health problems, but as far as physical health, they're pretty good.
Yeah, it's surprising how the body can't live without the mind. And if you're under a communist dictatorship, you don't have the opportunity to exercise your mind all that much, especially if you're incapable of exercising free speech.
Especially then, and thank you for the opportunity for me to do that here.
Hey, it's got to be done, mate. I've been doing it for years and years and years. I figured as a young man that my elders possess far more knowledge than I, and that the general public, of which I include myself, possesses far less. So I've endeavored to interview as many of my learned and wise and well-informed elders as possible for the benefit of not only them, having the ability to tell their story in a comfortable and safe environment, but so the listeners can actually learn something really deeply, you know, not just 30-second soundbite BS. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This deserves more coverage than it gets. And I'm on a one-man mission to change that reality.
Well, staying on the theme of food and replenishable food, Native American, well, throughout North America, at least, they had what they called the Three Sisters, beans, corn, and squash. Between those three, you get just about everything you need. You have to eat a pancreas of some animal now and then to get a little vitamin C. The Inuit, the Eskimos, et cetera, they'll eat a seal pancreas. They'll divide it up evenly amongst all the members of their family or tribe or their community. But that's how they survive without getting the rickets or scurvy or any of those other dastardly vitamin C deficiency diseases. When the English were sailing the world and, let's see, what, how would you say that? Subjugating much of the world, they put limes on the ships, and everybody got a pint of rum and a lime every day on the ship. And it kept them somewhat healthy and, well, satiated at least. But if the ancients, long before 10,000 years before the English were sailing the oceans, they had to have some plant that provided vitamin C for the sailors. In Egypt, they have the lily, the water lily. And in America, the Americas, they have the water lily. And they're both very high in vitamin C. Even though they're actually two different plants that look alike, they're still both high in vitamin C. And they would have provided enough of that commodity to keep a sailing crew healthy during a voyage across the ocean.
Didn't American sailors also have cranberries?
Yes. Once we were settled, they had cranberries. But until then, cranberries weren't known in the old world. Neither was pineapple, coffee, tomatoes, tobacco, maize or corn, most of the squash, a lot of the gourds, etc., are New World plants that have permeated the entire populated planet. And people don't think about that very often. But there were some 400 species of plants, animals, parasites, you name it, that were transported into populations long before Columbus ever sailed. So that tells me that somebody was sailing.
Yeah, and it wasn't Rod Stewart.
No. No, it was not. It wasn't Admiral Halsey either. But
yeah. Although it may have been Hogan's Heroes.
It could have been, yeah.
We can't confirm nor deny that one.
I know nothing.
I know nothing. That's Sergeant Shaw. You know, and it's amazing. He was actually quite being literal on occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen, as well as Blue Shield. You can go to the website and you scroll down. You can see the Blue Shield banner and you can click on that and order your plug-in and portable devices as well. We will see you after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. And remember, sorry, before we go, to go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And start making a regular donation today, preferably into that bank account there. For the Kiwi listeners internationally, I think it might be a little bit difficult. So that's why there's also a PayPal option there as well. So you give us a monthly gift of anywhere from $1 to $100 a month, depending on your resources. Please don't donate if you can't feed your family or house yourself. Don't do that, because then I feel guilty for you putting yourself out for me. It's supposed to be the other way around, mate. Okay? Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today. And we'll see you after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. The fabulous, the fluoridated, the Fukushima irradiated, where everybody has a job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest, Rick Osmond. That's not Jamaican, is it? In Jamaica, everybody just calls you Osmond.
Yeah, pretty much. And everybody in the United States as well. I'm called a lot of things and I answer to most of them, but don't call me late for supper. And you never knew my mother. So let's leave her out of it.
This is true.
Yeah.
Now, we were talking about, over the break, bureaucratic mindsets. Now, I've talked to a lot of free thinking people and I've talked to a lot of bureaucratically unthinking people. And it's ironically enough, quite the battle, because one's too stupid to admit that they don't know what they're talking about, and the other's honest enough to admit that they don't know everything, and so the other person think that gives them one over on them because they're just that freaking stupid.
Yeah, it has to do a lot with the number of letters after a name and what those letters are, as to the perception of the person who has those letters of the other person. Sorry, it does not define intellect. It does not define logic, nor does it define street sense, which is where most of them are totally lacking.
I want to have the fiduciary undergraduate qualification, so after my name, I can have the letters FU.
Yes, there you go. Of course, we have our own insurance problems here with universal health care that isn't universal. And it's not about health care. It's about taxation.
It's not universal at all. It's barely galactic, if anything.
Yeah, it's not even pervasive on our population as to who can get the coverage or what level of coverage they can get. But, hey, we're not here to talk about those politics, I hope.
We could talk about them. I mean, if you feel like
we could, but I'm too old to risk a heart attack becoming irate about it.
You know, sometimes I find getting really irate and getting something out prevents heart attacks.
It can, especially on topics of bureaucracy. I've fought a lot of it. I've won on a rare occasion, but then the ramifications of that are just about as bad as the bureaucracy in the first place.
Yeah. They're a toxin, a cancer. And you can only benefit from bureaucracy if you don't have anything to do with it.
When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, I said, well, it's not really because Saddam's an asshole, although he was. It's not really because they violated some 936 instances of the UN sanctions. It is because that's where bureaucracy was invented. And it should be destroyed.
Yeah. All right. Bureaucracy was invented in Mesopotamia, which is incidentally the reason why they make a mess of everything.
Yeah, pretty much. They also invented writing, according to most of the historians. But without writing, they're not historians because they don't like oral traditions.
Have you noticed that without writing, there would be no grammar Nazis?
Well, I don't know. I like good grammar. I like bad grammar. I just like communication. Open, honest communication.
Yeah. Which
the grammar Nazis don't really care about that.
No, they don't. It's like you'll say something really profound, something life-changing, an idea that will actually have an impact on the way somebody lives their life forever in perpetuity. And these people come in angry and criticize the incorrect positioning of the comma.
Yeah, I like commas. I'd use a comma after every word. Oh, sometimes I do, but just to piss them off.
Apparently, what was his name? John Key, he's the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Incidentally, there was also recently Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister of Australia, was on primetime television. And there was actually a typo that said Prime Sinister. You would.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was on the wrong continent for that one.
I've been using that term for years, the Prime Sinister and scumbaggery. And every time somebody somebody famous says Prime Sinister or scumbaggery, I always get emails from listeners telling me about this stuff. But check it out, the SD.
Yeah, your level of vindication just rose quite a bit, I think.
But. Yeah, well, you know, my name is Vinny, so vindication is implied.
There you go. It is.
Yeah.
There are a number of incidents without backing of historians that occurred in history that the historians don't want to talk about, and most of them involve sinister politicians. There is a very broad, not fine, but broad line between leaders and politicians. I don't care where you are in time or space, history, now, future, politicians suck. Leaders are hard to find. So there's my thought for the day.
And that is a really good closing thought. Conveniently, we have another 20 minutes.
Well, I'll try to come up with another one during that time.
Yeah.
But, and coming up with things is not exactly what I do. I synthesize information that already exists. In a few very rare cases, I go find new sites to investigate or whatnot. In one instance, I wrote a magazine article for Ancient American Magazine, and I invited readers, hey, if you know of a site that matches this description, stone walls near a body of water on a high hill, and set criteria for the type of site I was looking for. And oh, by the way, it has to be very old. Send me an email. And one guy did. And I recently took Dr. James Shears to that site so that he could investigate it. He specializes in surveying ancient sites to see if there are archaeoastronomy configurations on it, or anything else that might indicate some kind of mathematical basis for a site. We haven't found a mathematical basis for this site, but he agrees that it is ancient and it is very strange.
How old does something have to be before it piques your interest? I mean, are we talking David Rockefeller old or George H.W. Bush old?
To pique my interest in my particular area of study right now, it would have to be before Columbus. So, you know, 540 years, give or take. 1,000 years is what is considered an ancient period of time. And there are plenty of those. This particular site has some 300-year-old trees growing into a stone wall. So that tells me it was before white settlers got here, give or take, at least to that part of Indiana. There were white settlers west of here, but not east of here. And this site is anomalous. That's the best word I can use right now. I don't know how to explain it. It doesn't exactly fit the description of a fortress. It might possibly have been a lookout / signal spot. It's on a hill overlooking a river that was navigable for a stretch. And it fits into a network of communications, hills and man-made lookouts, stone towers. This one has stone supporting parts of the hill, possibly for defense, although it doesn't really fit that description well. It could have been if there was a palisade there. We'll have to do some digging, some further investigation to determine that. It has a cave that could have provided a steady stream of water, so it could have been like a water wheel to do work of some kind. But it's up on top of a steep hill, so it would have taken a lot of work to get goods up there to grind them and then take them back down. So that one doesn't work out all that well either. I don't know what's up with it, but we're going to try to figure it out. It's old, so that's why I like it. And it's a mystery. I like it even more.
Yeah. Hey, who doesn't like an old mystery? It was certainly enough for Scooby-Doo and the gang.
Yeah, for a couple decades they chased ghosts that weren't ghosts. They were always bad guys out for money.
Yeah.
Or something.
And incidentally, when you're investigating a hell of a lot of ancient sites around the world, that's exactly what you find. Bad guys chasing after money. All through the history books it is.
In one form of wealth or another has been the basis, the motive for expansion, for conquest, for whatever. It's always about wealth of some kind.
The accumulation of things. Now this occurs to me to be the psychopathic mindset, right?
To one degree or another, I concur. No. It's psychopathic. It's sociopathic because, well, let's go back to the Spanish Inquisition. They enslaved everybody in the New World and killed them or used them or, you know, just whatever for the benefit of the Spanish crown and a little bit for the church. Well, with the blessing of the church because, well, they weren't Christian, therefore they didn't matter. Yeah. And it all goes back to that papal bull of 1452, which was entitled Terra Nullius, literally empty land, empty of Christians. If there were people there and they were not Christians, they were less than property. And you could have the land and you could do whatever you wanted with the people who were not Christians and therefore didn't matter.
Yep. Doesn't that sound like Iraq? Doesn't that sound like Afghanistan?
Well, there were a lot of Christians in both those places, but they weren't in power.
That's true.
Vietnam, the same way. Vietnam was missioned by the French Catholics a lot, but it was occupied by communists, a part of it was. Now it all is. So, yeah, that's an excuse. I mean, that's a reason.
Mm.
Eddie Izzard, you know who Eddie Izzard is, right? The comedian stand-up guy. He said, anybody with a flag can claim a country, especially if that country doesn't have its own flag.
Oh, was that Eddie Izzard, is it?
Well, one of many, but he puts it more comedic than most people do. That's what the first thing that Columbus did when he got to the West Indies was plant two flags. He planted his flag of Spain and the flag of the Catholic Church. Said a little ceremony and, hey, now we own it. Oh, you guys that are living here, too bad for you.
Yeah, it's like, it's a shame you didn't get here fast enough with that flag of yours, mate.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll just take it. And have you noticed that what happens, this is happening just kind of on a micro as well as a macro level all throughout history and all throughout current society, isn't it? You know, psycho comes in, just takes what you have, and then if you say different, you try to defend or take it back, he kills you or destroys your life in some way. Isn't that happening all over the place?
Yes, still does. It takes a little different form, and it has a more sophisticated professional spin to it, but it is the same tactics.
Now, can I ask you to ponder this for a moment? What if, like, there's a psychopathic kind of sociopathic tendency that runs all the way through humanity, and it permeates out, it takes control by instinct, these people, of influential parts of society. They need entourages, they need fans, they need people to love them because they've got no love for anybody. So naturally they become doctors, lawyers, entertainers, politicians, etc.
Yeah, I knew that one was coming.
And as a result, the entire world is now controlled in a very real sense in all the major influential sectors of society by psychopaths or borderline psychopaths or psychopathic little helpers.
Who don't believe that they are those things.
Yeah.
That's self-delusion on top of the rest of it.
Yeah. So it's self-delusion brought on by psychopathic influence, right? It's like they can get you under a spell. And I think this is starting to come around for me because Carlos Castaneda talked about these, what were they called, snake demons or something like that, that can bind to people and take them over. It's like, it's not just human, these actions that these people are taking. It's devoid of what humans are meant to be. And what's ironic is when people look through human history and they see all the bad things that have been done by these psychopathic scumbaggery pieces of trash, they then blanket all of humanity as bad and they ignore all the really good, compassionate, loving, kind things that we do for each other every day.
Right, but they'll still parade out, you know, photographs or even living people like Mother Teresa and say, look, we have great people. Well, you don't have great people. They are great people, but you don't have them. You're using them. That's a big difference.
I think a person should be taken aside in a lot of cases and you have a look at their actions and what they achieve. Like you take, let's say Mother Teresa, for instance. One thing that she allegedly did was take care of a lot of people, and sure enough, some statistics are there to support that a lot of people got taken care of because of her actions. There's also those other group of people who were in intense pain, and her extreme belief in being around suffering brought her, bringing her closer to God, human suffering around her, bringing her closer to God. How does this sound? That she would actually force these bedbound people to stay in bed, not move, and get bed sores and all of this kind of thing, and actually prolong and increase their suffering in an attempt to get closer to God.
Yeah, that whole thing about closer to God is the reason I chose her as an example. You also have other, I hesitate to use the word, but it fits here, iconic people who have done good deeds, and those deeds have been exaggerated a great deal, but they're still they, the controllers of society, of the planet, use those people as a smokescreen for what's really causing the pain in the first place.
Yeah.
As an example.
Well, like you could hold up Martin Luther King and his assassination. And you remember it and all the great speeches and all the good things he did for the Black Civil Rights Movement. But you don't hear about Planned Parenthood taking out 80 million black unborn children.
You don't hear about a liquor shop,
a gun shop, and a pawn shop next to each other in every major black urban center.
And almost universally owned by... historically whites, but now it's moving into Asian owning those, or Near Easters.
Slavery didn't end, ladies and gentlemen, at the Civil War. It only began.
Well, it began on a larger segment of the population. And in fact, Civil War did not end legally at the end of the Civil War. The Emancipation Proclamation that Abraham Lincoln penned and signed did not carry the force of law. It's merely a proclamation. I proclaim it's evil and it should end. It wasn't a law. Before the war started, Lincoln, this is another period of American history that I really enjoy. Lincoln was in support of the 13th Amendment in an entirely different form that would have preserved slavery in the Southern states as long as those Southern states paid an inordinate amount of tax to the federal government. And yet he's considered the great emancipator. It wasn't about emancipation, it was about taxation. There's that whole wealth sociopathy thing again. He broke every tenet of the United States Constitution to win a war based on money.
And I think this comes to the most important realization in my life. Good people who are great leaders don't want power over other people. They want to empower other people.
Right.
Bad guys, on the other hand, who are great leaders, do the exact opposite. They need to have power over other people, and they convince them that giving up their own personal freedoms and power is a great idea.
Yeah. And Lincoln was very adept at that. As an example, during his campaign for Congress, before he was running for president, he sought the support of a guy in Southern Illinois by the name of John Crenshaw. John Crenshaw held 715 slaves in Illinois. And he had special dispensation from the Illinois legislature, which was a non-slave state, to hold slaves in Illinois because, well, you couldn't get white folks to work those jobs, which was probably true. But still, Illinois, home of a number of presidents, including Lincoln and Obama, they have a very sketchy record of empowerment for the lowest parts of society. And Southern Illinois wanted to fight with the South.
The South shall rise again.
Pretty much. There were, in Indiana, as an example, during the Civil War, we had, I believe it was about 128,000 volunteers for the Union. And hey, we're proud of that. But what you don't find in many history books, and certainly not in any university history books, is that there were about 30,000 volunteers for the Confederacy from Indiana. And more than that, there were about 60,000 draft dodgers from Indiana.
Unbelievable.
Drafted into the Union Army. And they'd rather run and eat bugs than fight for the Union.
Do you recall the beginning of the film Braveheart, where he says, those historians will say I am a liar, for history is written by those who have hanged heroes?
Well, it is true, Julius Caesar being one of those. Julius Caesar tried to invade Great Britain in, I believe it was 53 BC, something like that. And he had a Roman armada of ships and troops. And the Welsh, because all of southern part of Great Britain at that time, southern part of the British Isles, I should say, were the Cymry, or Cymry. And they spoke Cymry, and they were the Cymry people, and they used a Colbran language, which he talked about in his journals. But he was able to escape the 700 ships they raised in 4 days. Therefore, it was a victory, and he was a great leader. Hmm. Well, if he was that great a leader, why didn't he just convince him to become part of the Roman Empire? If he were truly a great leader, it's a matter of persuasion rather than conquest.
I forget the name of the of which Roman leader it was. It may have even been Caesar, but they had no men around them. You know how some people have yes men all around them? One Roman leader specifically had no men, like people to keep him in check and that kind of thing. And then incidentally, they all hatched a conspiracy amongst themselves, all as no men, to kill him and take over.
Sure. Yeah, Julius Caesar was stabbed by every member of the Roman Senate.
You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Don't become a leader, folks. It's just not worth it.
Don't become a politician, for sure. And we're getting ready for, tomorrow is an election day here for a minor local offices and what they call a primary election here before they go to a general election in the fall.
All right.
Midterm. It's not a presidential election, but a few senators, congressmen, et cetera, well, all the congressmen are running for re-election this fall. And it's a circus. I don't care how you look at it. Even on the local races, it's a circus. Even the sheriff's race here is a circus.
When you said running for office, an image popped into my mind of, you know, when you come into the kitchen late at night and you turn the light on, you see a cockroach or something scuttle into the darkness again. That's what image kind of came into my mind. You know, all of a sudden the lights are on and these little cockroaches are out for everybody to see, and then they're scuttling away to get into position so that they can infect you with disease and eat away the goodness of your society like termites do a good table.
And ruin all of your stored foodstuffs.
Yeah, and your children's future. Rick Osman, was my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget to check out the Ancient America Conference on July 12th, 2014. You can get that on Facebook there. And also, Rick, you have websites of some note, don't you?
A couple of them. AncientAmerica.com, which is not the same as AncientAmericanMagazine.com, but we kind of interact. I also administer and contribute to another one that some of your listeners might like, TheHollowEarthInsider.com, which is also named THEI.US, same site, different names. And it's more the conspiracy stuff than you might think about Hollow Earth theory. So I have fun with those.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to... you could probably fill up another interview gap with an entire Hollow Earth episode as well, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pretty sure.
All right. Well,
you can't cover it all in a couple hours.
No, you can't. You can't. That's why they're called episodes.
Yes.
Rather than the whole ball of wax. Rick Osman, ladies and gentlemen, ancientamerica.com, ancientamericamagazine.com, and which was the Hollow Earth one again, sorry?
TheHollowEarthInsider.com.
Earthinsider.com. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast. So if you are listening to this and you are already a regular subscriber through the PayPal, the PayPal email has changed to gorillamedia77@gmail.com. The details there are on the homepage, and simply cancel your old subscription and just subscribe again with the PayPal button on the page. All the things have been changed. PayPal does this every year. They just kind of like freeze one of my PayPal accounts and ask for documentation that I don't have, like proof that I'm at some kind of charitable organization and everything like that, which I never claim because it's a merchant account, and they don't answer any of your emails, and they always use the word repetitively. You know what the word is, don't you? Unfortunately. You've had an employer tell you that?
Yeah, it has a twin, denied.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's the thing. Bureaucracy can't be reasoned with. It's kind of like the Terminator in that way, you know?
Yeah. And you got to reprogram them.
People don't get it, okay? There are only two things certain in life, death and taxes. Okay?
That's right.
And people haven't figured out that it's the taxes that's killing you.
They do coexist well.
You know, it's not a chicken and egg scenario, ladies and gentlemen. There is a clear causal relationship, in my opinion. Okay.
Certainly.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Dan,
thank you. I've enjoyed this a great deal. Hope we can do it again.
I hope we can, too. And just hold on the line there after we get off here. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.